this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Dan Schill about how he is using sex reversal of fish to combat invasive species in the western U.S. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Dr. Dan Schill. Dan holds a bachelor's degree from Clarion State College, a master's degree from Idaho State University, and a PhD from the University of Idaho. He was employed in a variety of research and management positions with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game from 1982 up until last August when he retired with the state of Idaho. His last position with the state was as a fishery research supervisor, where he led an innovative effort for controlling invasive species. Dan has recently expanded his research footprint to work as a consultant for the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, forming a company, Fisheries Management Solutions, that continues his work to control invasive species. When not playing with fish, Dan takes care of his three llamas and is currently trying to revamp his pack string for hunting and fishing purposes. Welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Thank you, Nick. Good to be here.
Dan, there was a family growing up kind of across the valley from me that had llamas, and they always cleaned house at the county fair because no one else had llamas. I guess what got you into having a pack of llamas?
Well, my profession. I carried a backpack shocker up too many streams, and it carried too many elk out, perhaps, but I ended up with a bad back at the age of 30 and didn't want to not be able to run around in the backcountry. So I got a pack string and have had one since 1993 in some form or another. The current collection of three is not quite as good as my old string. So I'm trying to revamp a little bit, but that's what got me started. And, you know, they're just a great animal for getting you in the middle of nowhere. And Idaho's got a lot of wilderness areas. So
that's definitely a different thing to look out for than what I have to deal with here in Kansas. But this isn't the llama podcast, so I guess we'll get back to it. Dan, you originally started school at Clarion State College in Pennsylvania. I guess what got you to move all the way out to Idaho?
Well, I was a trout stream fisherman, and I liked to go out west in all the summers that I was an undergraduate and kind of roamed around out west for a month in my vehicle. And so I had decided in high school that I wanted to be a trout stream biologist. And so the West called when it came time to learn my trade. And I applied for a few schools out west. And lo and behold, Idaho State called and wanted to know if I wanted to work on a project in Yellowstone National Park, which just happened to be my favorite place to fish in the country. So that's how I got to Idaho, and I've not left.
Just like yourself, being a non-native to Idaho, a common issue across the United States is the introduction of non-native species in the fish world. And so then a common task is the removal or control of these species. Idaho kept you around, but what are some of the invasive species Western states are dealing with, and how have they traditionally been managed?
You know, there's a number of species in the West introduced over time, sometimes by government, more lately more by anglers who want fish to, you know, from their hometown, so to speak, and they move them around illegally. Brook trout have been around for many years, introduced originally by the federal government. They're one of the problem species. Common carp is prominent out west, not quite as prominent or as quite a big a problem as maybe in your Midwestern waters, but common carp is the most destructive invasive fish worldwide by kind of popular claim amongst biologists. You know, there's some other species. Walleye is a difficult problem fish out west. These species typically don't have natural predators, or they are the predators themselves that wipe out the native fish of the area. And the typical approaches are some kind of manual removal, which has been tried for many species. Common carp, people have been trying to remove common carp populations and manage them down to livable numbers with very little success in a lot of places. though a little bit more success in the last 5 years, trying some multi-method approaches. But they've been pretty difficult. Brook trout, same thing. People try to remove them from streams using vector fishing, a sampling method that fish biologists use to collect fish. But you just never get rid of them all. A few of them survive and they're in the brush piles and you can't get rid of them. And then, of course, you have to keep doing this forever, it seems, and people run out of energy and you end up right back where you started. Eventually, the entity or the folks trying to get rid of these populations are beaten by the fish themselves. So that's been the problem. The other one that has worked, really the only one that's really worked to get rid of invasive fish consistently, has been the use of rotenone, which is a plant extract from South America that's related, I think it's from the Darris root, but that's a plant-based substance that when it's refined can kill fish, and it's quite effective, even though you don't always get all of them, these invasives that way, but it has worked at times. Unfortunately, it kills all fish species when you use it, and it also kills other aquatic insects and other things. So basically, we have one tool that's kind of it's not real flexible. A lot of folks are getting more and more concerned about its use. The other techniques don't really work very well. This method that we kind of been we're going to talk about is something that's kind of come along fairly recently with some hope that maybe it'll do a better job.
Just mentioned it there, you and many other collaborators are working on a new method of eradicating invasive fish species. I guess, how is your method different from the previous ones you just mentioned?
The ones that I've been talking about, they involve removing the invasive fish from the stream, and that's basically it. The stream or a lake, you're either killing the fish and removing them from the population, or with a rotenone or a chemical approach. There are several different chemicals that can be used, or you're going to go out there manually and just net up fish and remove them and kill them. Usually those are provided to, in the case of some of the fish that we're doing this for in Idaho, we provide them to food banks and whatnot, but you're just removing things. And the big difference with what we're doing, something called the YY male approach, you are going to stalk fish on the landscape. And that's completely different and kind of counterintuitive to your listeners. It's like, well, how are you going to get rid of these fish if you're going to stalk them? So I think we'll get into the discussion a little bit. So that is the big difference between what people have been doing to get rid of invasives and Idaho Fish and Game's approach that we've been working with.
So you mentioned that you're stalking fish and it's kind of counterintuitive. What's different about the fish you're stalking compared to the ones you're trying to get rid of?
Well, most of your listeners probably are aware of the basic genetics of humans and most mammals. And most fish, females, have two X chromosomes, and a male fish has an X and a Y chromosome. And the male, then the sex of the male is what determines the sex of the progeny. In essence, it's the Y chromosome. And what we're doing in our process is figuring out a way to produce fish that, instead of being typical genetic males, XYs, are genetically their YY. And that sounds kind of scary, I suppose, to some folks, but this kind of process, it's called developing a monosex brood stock, and this is a 50-year-old approach that's used quite commonly in the aquaculture world. For example, in the rainbow trout world, commercial growers really don't want mixed sex fish to grow up to raise for a restaurant business or to be sold in a supermarket. They want fish of the same size. They want them to be pretty and silvery on the side. They don't want male fish. Male fish color up. They start to develop sexually early. They don't grow as well. You get fish trying to spawn with each other when the commercial folks want these fish to be growing nicely and putting on fish flesh that people like to eat. So this development of sex reverse brood stock is kind of old hat, and it's been done for a large number of species, tilapia and a number of other things. So what we're doing isn't really all that new, which is kind of what I like. I'm kind of a fisheries history buff. And the fact that somebody did this in Japan in 1958, the year I was born, or sometime like that, I find very amusing.
Some animals, reptiles, have their sex determined by temperature. How is it exactly that you're able to alter the sex of a fish to produce all male or female offspring?
Well, the process is actually pretty simple. Each fish, and for that matter, reptiles, there's a certain period of their development, not long after they hatch usually, where they are, their sex is being determined by their that organism. They are genetically a male or a female, but they start out with very simple cells called PGC cells that are the precursors to the fishes of gametes and gametic cells. And they start to develop into a male or female, of course, based on genetics at a certain time. And if you know the window for differentiation and the number of days after the fish is hatched, for example, when it starts to differentiate, you start to feed it fish feed that has been sprayed with a typical sex hormone, then you can fool those cells and sex reverse the fish. If you feed it the feed long enough at the right dosage, you can get a male fish, a genetic XY male, to produce eggs. The fish's cells are fooled into thinking it's a female. And in the case of the broodstock that we're working with, we're using a hormone known as estradiol, which is the very same drug that many women take post-menopause or having had a hysterectomy, like my wife has taken estradiol for years. So it's the same hormone produced by females and males, humans, and basically every mammal and fish on the planet releases this hormone. It's just that you feed a fish a little bit more of that than the cells are used to, and you can override its normal sex differentiation process. So what you end up with then is when you feed this in this first generation, you end up with a fish that's genetically male, but it produces eggs. And you rear that fish up for several years, in the case of brook trout, about a year and a half, and it starts to develop eggs. And when it's time to spawn, you spawn that fish, which is genetically an XY fish, and you spawn that with a male fish, a regular standard male, that's an XY fish. And when you do the math on that, 25% of the progeny of that cross, and in the case of brook trout, you might get anywhere from 800 to 1,000 eggs from that cross. One-fourth of those fish will be genetically YY fish. And that's the whole objective of this program, is to produce large numbers of these YY fish that you then grow up to survive a little bit better. You grow them up in a hatchery, and then you stock those fish out on the landscape. And if you readers and listeners think about that a little bit, you know, if you take a YY fish that a male, and it produces sperm, and it spawns with a wild brook trout out there on the landscape, for example, it's an XX fish. But all the progeny of that spawning event have to be XY. They have to be male fish. And that's it in a nutshell. That's the YY male approach, because females grow populations and males do not. Females produce eggs. That's what limits populations. So if you keep stocking males on the landscape and you keep skewing the sex ratio, you start to limit the number of females in the population. And we've done a number of studies with computer modeling, for example, and what we've learned from that is no big surprise. If you also, while you're stocking such fish out on the landscape, if you also remove wild fish out there from those streams while you're doing it and let your fish go, if you mark your fish, you can excise a little fin on trout called the adipose fin, so that when you go out and do removal work with nets and other things to remove wild fish, you increase the proportion of remaining fish in the stream that are YY male, and that speeds the process, basically. That's what we're currently researching and is causing quite a bit of excitement in the fish community. This, to my knowledge, has not been done worldwide yet. I think Idaho Fishing Game is the first entity to build such a brood stock and begin putting it on the landscape with the express purpose of attempting to eliminate an invasive population. So that's something that we've been working on for the last decade and is pretty well underway now in our state.
And so once these YY fish are introduced, how long or how many generations are you imagining it taking to reduce the numbers of the nuisance or invasive species?
Well, we really have no way of knowing for certain. Of course, the way you evaluate that before you start the program is you do these kind of computer simulations that I was mentioning. You build a trout population in a computer, basically based on all known levels and parameters that comprise a typical Western brook trout population. And then you remove different proportions of that population in the computer and stock in different numbers of YY fish to kind of get some sense of how well it would work. And will it work fast enough? And so depending on, you know, you have to make a bunch of assumptions when you do that kind of work. You have to assume that survival rates are as good as wild fish. Maybe you make some assumptions that they're not as good. And that's what we did in some simulations. We assumed that our fish that we're stocking out there, YY fish, survive as well as the wild males that are out there. That's something that probably isn't necessarily true. So we also did a series of simulations assuming that the survival of our fish was only one-fifth as good as the wild fish that were out there. So to get some idea how populations would respond across a range of possibilities. And when you do that, assuming that survival is good on these fish in a typical Idaho trout stream that we stocked them into, we concluded that we could expect the population to be completely eradicated of brook trout in between 4 and 7 or 8 years, which, if true, would be incredible compared to the past efforts that we've had in trying to use removal methods like electrofishing to get rid of fish. Now, if fish survival was really poor when we stocked them out there, it's going to take a little longer. It might take 8 or 10 years based on the simulations. That's not as good a news, but certainly I think would be of interest to a typical fish manager. So when we did these studies, which we did before we started stocking fish on the landscape, that was the question. Do we think it could work? And what were the probabilities that they would occur? And we concluded that it looks like a reasonable possibility for the brook trout, given the number of the fish that we're stocking and the number that we're removing, for example.
I'm sorry if you said it. Were your simulations just for stocking fish? They didn't account any additional harvest or removal of those fish as well?
No, I probably was unclear in that. It's kind of complicated. We did the simulation several ways. We simulated that you just stocked in YY fish into a population. So that would be just extra fish that would be going in and you'd hope they would be surviving, doing well. We compared how long that would take to fish that you remove. When you're removing wild fish at the same time, and I don't think I mentioned that the example that I gave you earlier of 4 to 7 years, that assumed we were stocking out fish on the landscape and removing 50% of the wild brook trout in the stream at the same time, and that we arrived at that 50% rate fairly simply. We have some really large sampling programs in Idaho, and one where we did one pass through a stream with a backpack electrofisher. We have found over the years with like 2,000 sites that you remove about 50% of the wild brook trout in a stream with a single pass through it with this electrofishing sampling device. So that's why we simulated 50%. That's not very much effort compared to what goes on in these typical brook trout removal efforts in streams, where people may run through 3 or 4 times and over a number of several miles, and it gets to just be so laborious. What we were trying to do is simulate something that would be much easier and more likely for managers in the field to want to do and be able to do manually, and and see if the benefit then of stocking on top of that sort of a reach, putting in YY fish, does that get you there, relatively quickly? And that's what we found. And it certainly gave us incentive to move forward in our research program. And since then, we have been putting fish out and are beginning to evaluate whether or not these fish actually survive and reproduce.
Well, it all sounds like a great idea. And to me, it sounds like it worked. But I'd imagine there is some backlash from those who oppose the use of sex-reverse fish. I guess, is there any thought out there that these fish will do more harm than good?
Well, there is, when we released some PR about this, of course, there was some discussion about this, but we were happy that people seemed to understand. Folks and listeners might be thinking, well, this sounds an awful lot like a GMO or a genetified modified organism, something that people are kind of uncomfortable with, whether it's corn or other things. You know, that's not a popular term right now. These fish are not a GMO for the simple reason that the definition of a GMO involves the splicing of genes or genetic material from another species into an existing one. And that's, in its essence, that's the definition of a GMO. And that's not what's done here. You're not altering any of the genetic, actual genetic material. It's just kind of being rearranged from gender. But there are several papers out there written before we even started this work that concluded that, you know, these fish are not a GMO. And so I think because of that, I think people have been a little bit more comfortable with this than one of the papers out there that was evaluating different genetic approaches for getting rid of invasive fish, written a few years ago, you know, said for that very reason that this approach that that we're talking about is the least likely to generate public controversy for that very reason. So happily, we have not got a lot of negative feedback on the use of these fish. I would note that because of this idea that we're not putting a GMO on the landscape and we're not altering the genome of the fish, that if we are in this program 4 or 5 years in a stream and the fish aren't quite extirpated, or maybe it's taking us longer for it to happen, and so people say, well, maybe we should just give up on this. The only thing that will happen if we stop stocking these fish in there is that the population sex ratio will just go back to 50-50, and the population will just be like we'd never started. And I think that makes people feel a little better about that situation. This isn't the same as stocking a hybrid fish or something like that, that when it's on the landscape, it's going to be out there forever. All we're trying to do is change the sex ratio, and you literally have to turn every fish into the stream virtually male before it's going to work. And you can always decide to give up, in which case it'll just go back to square one. Hopefully that's simplest I can explain. Hopefully that makes sense to you.
Yeah, it made perfect sense to me. And if there are any anglers fishing one of these streams where you're trying to eradicate brook trout, would they be able to distinguish the difference between a YY fish and a natural XY fish without noticing that one of the fins is clipped?
You know, not very likely. It depends. You know, we're trying several different sizes of these fish or ages of the fish in some of our research to see which might work best. If we stock the fish out as fingerlings, probably 5 to 7 inches long, the answer to your question is almost certainly not. You wouldn't be able to see any signs of fin erosion on those fish. They would look virtually the same as a wild fish. If we raise the fish up for a year and stock them out at the size that we call in our profession catchable size, meaning if you put them out there at 8 to 10 inches and they're already big enough to be caught by a fisherman, you might notice, if you're a discerning kind of a natural history buff as a fisherman, you might say, well, it looks like some of their fin rays are a little bit bent, or maybe eroded slightly. So some fishermen that really were kind of scooping to that might be able to tell, but I think the vast majority of anglers would never know. And, you know, from a food consumption standpoint, in the case of these brook trout, these fish have never been personally or by themselves have never been exposed to a hormone. Only their parents were, and those parents never leave the hatchery. They all stay in a covered tanks in our hatchery facility. So, you know, not only would sportsmen not be able to discern, I think in most cases, these fish, but they certainly wouldn't have any concerns about eating them either. At least from a food safety standpoint, they just haven't been around a chemical that might concern somebody. A bit on the chemical, I would note that this has caused a little confusion with biologists in my state until we explained it. But people were concerned that, boy, to produce these fish, you're probably using a lot of the drug. And in reality, we use just a tiny amount of estradiol to produce our entire brood stock of fish. A typical cow in a year, I'm trying to remember the exact number, I think it produces something like a gram of estrogen per year and releases it out onto the landscape, often into a stream, if the cow likes to hang around a stream, as they're kind of want to do in the hot weather. And they and we use milligrams, thousands of a milligram, just a few of those, to produce an entire brood stock. So, you know, again, from an ecological perspective, the amount of estradiol being produced by elk, deer, and yes, fish that are already in the stream pales in comparison to the amount we're using. We're able to sex reverse the fish only because we know the exact time that we need to get that feed to it, and we just end up using a very small amount of the drug to produce the brood stock. So again, this is, I think, another reason why that prior paper mentioned that this is an approach that should not be met with a great deal of consternation from the angling public. And I think most biologists, when you explain that to them, feel a heck of a lot better about it. Their initial reaction is, well, is this bad for the environment?
We've talked mostly about brook trout to this point, but you're also trying to develop YY fish for a whole slew of other species. What kind of other fish are you working on?
Well, you know, after about 5 years into our program, I think we started in 2008 on brook trout. And once we were well into it, after 4 or 5 years, and it looked like we had built a brood stock, I spent some time looking at the literature on some other species. And certainly the one that's the most of interest to fish managers across America, and I can guarantee you in your home state of Kansas and other Midwest states, is the common carp. It seriously alters water quality and vastly reduces game fish populations in many, many lakes. So that's the one that we set about working on second. We're just in the initial stages of that research, trying to develop what I call the recipe for feminizing a male carp. We were very fortunate in the case of brook trout that there was already a recipe. We already knew when it differentiated based on the research done in the 1970s in Canada, of all places. So we had the advantage there. We are working on common carp now and have had some success on that. I don't think we have the recipe quite completed, but we have room for optimism. We are also working on walleye, and I'm happy to report that they have not proved as difficult to feminize as the common carp. And in fact, you may know this, Nick, but we were working in your state of Kansas as one of the WAFLA partners there. Walleye are popular in your state, of course, but you have expertise on how to grow walleye, and both hatcher personnel in both states of Kansas and Iowa have pitched in to help the western states, because you know how to raise walleye. So we have some trials going in both of those states. And amazingly, the first go around, we tried a couple of different recipes or times that we exposed fish in those two states and different levels of the hormone. And we have resulted in 100% sex reversal for the walleye. So good news on that front. That has a number of folks in western states very excited about whether or not we'll be able to build a YY broodstock walleye in the next several years out west.
Just in case I forgot, or maybe we didn't go over it, you keep mentioning broodstock. Are these YY fish getting stocked themselves, or is it their progeny that get put out into the water?
No, I haven't. I've only mentioned that kind of obliquely, but the broodstock themselves, you end up, once you sex reverse these fish and spawn, you know, you sex reverse a XY male, and then you spawn it with a regular male. And as I indicated, 25% of those progeny will then be YY. And the way to build a brood stock then that will be able to produce large numbers of progeny is you take those 25% fish that are YY, and you split those into two groups, and you sex reverse half of those in another same process as I mentioned earlier. Then that produces a large number of fish that you can grow up that do become your brood stock. And they, in Idaho, stay in our hatchery in two round, large silos that are covered. And they, like the rest of our brood stock at that hatchery, their sole process is to produce eggs. And in this case, all of their eggs are genetically male, because you're spawning a egg-producing YY fish with a sperm-producing YY fish. So everybody's got to be YY, and you just rear those fish then to whatever size you want to stock on the landscape. But none of those progeny have ever been exposed to the drug, and that's kind of the thing about this approach. I would note that, you know, if that was the case, this particular hormone that we're using, estradiol, that's produced naturally by all female fish, and in lesser quantities even by the males, as I recall. It breaks down rather quickly into two or three metabolic derivatives of estradiol, and then it's just gone from the fish quickly. So even if we were to release fish that had been treated with the drug as a fry, the research done in the 1970s has since then clearly shows that the drug is gone once the fish metabolizes it over a matter of only a couple of days. As I said, that's not a process that we need to use in the case of brook trout in any event, but that's just kind of an interesting, I guess, subtext.
You mentioned that you're working on common carp and you've almost got walleye figured out. Is there any fish out there that you're thinking about working on next or the other collaborators are thinking about?
Well, I haven't mentioned the others. We are also working through this Western Consortium that I'm kind of overseeing. We're working on lake trout, which is another challenging species in the West, in Yellowstone Park and in Idaho and several waters where they just are too, they're long lived and they're the apex predator that's causing us great problems. But we are working on lake trout, and there are two new species that I'm just beginning to do some work on, just exploratory at this stage, of course, to see whether or not we can get the first stages in. And those are the northern pike and the brown trout. So there are places, particularly in the desert southwest and some other areas, where brown trout are very problematic and are kind of taking over whole systems and wiping out the few remaining native fish that we have. Certainly northern pike are a major problem in Alaska and in some other states in the West. And we have some anglers moving these fish around, unfortunately, without understanding what the implications are to the fisheries in question. I should say that there are really two things you need to do to build this kind of a brood stock. You have to have some good aquaculture skills, although that's not really magic. As I've been kind of harping on, you have to be able to sex reverse a male fish. You have to be able to make it grow eggs, which is, it turns out, not all that hard. That's been done for over 100 fish species now. This kind of process to sex reverse fish is very common in the commercial industry. The other thing you have to be able to do, if you're going to sex reverse a fish by feeding it food, it's going to have eggs, and you won't be able to distinguish it genetically. If you sacrifice it or spawn it, you won't be able to tell the difference genetically between it and a real female XX fish. So there is a bit of razzmatazz in this process. You need to have what's known as a sex marker, which in English for the rest of this just turns out to be a genetic sex test. And fortunately, Idaho Fish and Game has a well-established genetics lab and staff that's been supporting since around 2001. And that lab, if you take a fin clip off of a brook trout of any size in the state of Idaho and hand that fin clip over to our genetics lab, they don't need to know anything else about the fish, but they can tell us in very short order whether that is a genetic male or a female. And that test is what we use when we're trying to develop a brood stock and we're looking back at these sex-averse fish. We need to know which ones are the XY egg producers, because those are the ones that are like gold. The XX fish that are swimming around in the tank, even though we've exposed them to estradiol, they couldn't use it. They're already girls, and they're worthless to us. We cull those. We don't keep those in our brood stock, of course. We're only after the XY egg producers, and we need the sex marker to do that. So that's the hard part in some of this work, is getting the sex markers developed. And our genetics lab is working on that for these other species. Some of the sex markers are not as easy to get as others. The brook trout one was fairly well put together at the beginning. We needed some work. We got some help from several collaborators on that one. We've got a pretty good sex marker for the common carp that's working in one population that we're working with in Idaho. But then when we try to apply that to other populations of fish out there across the landscape, where we sacrifice 8 or 10 fish, we cut them open, we see if they're male or female, and then we use our sex marker developed in Idaho, we don't see that that little sex genetic test is accurate. So that means we need to go back to the drawing board. So we're making progress on the sex markers in our lab, but that's the other part of this process. So it's not just a simple use of an old school technology. It's mixing the old with the new. And I do think that's the cool part of this work that we're doing. We're using state-of-the-art genetics equipment and methods, and we're combining that with this kind of old-school commercial aquaculture approach to combat invasive fish. Who would have thought?
Well, Dan, thank you for filling me in on all that. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
What is my favorite fish? My favorite fish is the Yellowstone cutthroat. I just fell in love with the thing when I was back east. The easiest trout to catch. It's quite gorgeous, of course, and it is Idaho's state fish. We have several different subspecies of the cutthroat trout, and that's the first fish I worked on for my master's degree and as a professional fish biologist, and I guess it's my favorite fish. And if I would be given just a little bit more liberty, I got to confess that even though my job is to get rid of brook trout in the West, I'm a conflicted man, I tell people, because I grew up in Pennsylvania where the brook trout is the native fish, and I really do love brook trout where they belong, and I actually like to eat brook trout out west. So I would have to say that the very species that I'm trying to get rid of in some populations in the West where they're not very desirable would be a close second for my favorite fish. So how's that for a kind of a warped fish biologist story?
Oh, that's just perfect. So then the second question is, what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Boy, favorite memory. Boy, geez, you really got me on that. My favorite memory. Wow. 36 years in the field. I've had a lot of good memories on a lot of different species and places. I can honestly say I think that maybe the coolest thing I ever observed in the field was in a spawning population of bull trout up in Rapid River in the headwaters of that drainage. Very large bull trout, up to 30 inches long, were spawning in a stream about 10 feet wide, and they were completely oblivious to us. We were able to walk amongst them while they were spawning, and we were watching big males fighting over the females and driving, the main male was driving other male competitors away. But then little tiny males would sneak in and spawn with the female over and over again. And we watched one male outwitted, a 25-inch male, outwitted by a 6-inch little resident male a dozen times. Another competitor male would approach, the silly big male drove it away, and the little brook trout or the little bull trout jumped up between two rocks, hopped up and spawned with the female, and the big one was never the wiser. And we talked about that ever since. That was back in 1993, my fish partner and I, and we thought about that being a Marlin Perkins moment. And for those listeners old enough, they would remember this as an outdoor show that many of us watched as kids. It was to see it happening over and over again was cool biologically, but it was also just funny. It was just watching this thing go on the landscape. So that has to be maybe my favorite experience looking at a fish in my career.
That sounds like a really neat thing to see. And you mentioned you kind of had to rack your brain from a whole bunch of other favorite memories. And so the third question is, what is your dream job or dream location? But you've just retired, so I guess, do you have a dream job or dream location?
Well, I think I have my dream job now. I've had a number of dream jobs in my career. I was Idaho's wild trout research biologist for, 10 years. Then I supervised that project. Then I became the research supervisor. Each time I thought I had my dream job. And the only thing that lured me away from that job as the research supervisor was a job working on YY fish for 13 Western states with fisheries chiefs or program leaders that are all as excited about the project and the program as I am. So I think I have the dream job working with a number of states. I get to travel to states and learn about new species and get to work with hatchery staff that know how to raise a walleye, know how to raise a northern pike. I know nothing about that, but I come with the knowledge of how to sexiverse the fish, hopefully, and have read the literature. So it's it's just a great opportunity to work with folks outside the state that I've labored at for so long, the state of Idaho. So this job I'm in, I'm getting to work in the state of Alaska. I'm working in Arizona, Iowa, with just a great bunch of people all trying to do something new. And that, if you happen to be a researcher, is a pretty good deal. So I think I've got my dream job. I've caught it. And I don't really know how long I'm going to do it, but I certainly see no end in sight for some time.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Oh, boy. What is one project I'd like to work on? Well, you know, in my present capacity, I used to be a lot more diverse in the research topics that I work on. But now that I'm just kind of working on YY fish, if I had money and no object, the one thing I'd like to do is be working on Asian carp as a possible species where YY fish might have some utility. Perhaps west, where they're already in huge numbers, like in Illinois and some of the rivers, main stem and the Mississippi, where there's just already incredible numbers of them. I would be, I think, fascinated with possibly developing a YY tool for Asian carp where they are just about to invade, where there are very few or none of them, but they're just about to get there. And maybe we could stop upstream migrations of that particularly destructive duo species, big head and the silver carp. So if money were no object, I think that's what I'd like to do, or at least help somebody do sometime down the road.
Well, there might be enough money out there that money might not be an issue for a project like that.
Well, that's possible. I've got my hands full right now, but it's only a matter of time, I think, before we ought to give that a go.
All right, Dan, the final question. If there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Well, I'm not sure I can conjure any advice for the general population other than I think as humans, and particularly in the research context, I heard a saying recently that describes research, and that saying is, research is formalized curiosity. It is poking and prying with a purpose. And I think that makes a good researcher. I think that makes a good voter. I think that makes a good citizen. I think being curious and figuring things out and poking and prying and trying to figure out the facts for yourself as you move forward in your life is something that we all ought to do, whether we're paid to do it as researchers or whether we're trying to understand the latest political controversy or how to proceed on an environmental issue or anything else like that. So I guess be curious. And that's the advice I'd give for just about anybody.
All right, Dan, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It truly was a pleasure hearing about you and the work you're doing up there in Idaho and Kansas and all the other Western states. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Well, I can give you my email address, and that email is dschill, S-C-H-I-L-L, at fishmgmtsolns.com.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. You can download and subscribe to receive the remaining episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 54th episode of the Fisheries Podcast, and remember, be curious.